How's it going, Richard?
Very well, thank you very
much.
My
name's Jonathan. Vice Roy with DL Radio.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. And what I want to do is get you over here and interview you and talk about your game, which you're coming out with, Tabula Rasa,
yep.
And talk about that a little bit. And also talk about, you know, Ultima Line, what how you came up with the name for Ultima,
yep.
And stuff like that. So let me start out with the question, how did you come up with the name for Ultima?
Well, what's funny is, you know, in fact, of course, that's a way back in history kind of question that, oddly, I haven't been asked in probably 20 years. But the original name of the Ultima series was Ultimatum. And back when I was first developing it, we actually had trouble copywriting that name because there was some board game or something with the same name. And so we just truncated it. We just shortened it to Ultima.
Mm-hmm.
Stuck there ever since.
Oh, okay. So, you know, we've been talking with other game developers here. We talked with LaRoshan. I'm sure you met him. And
oh, yes, of course.
We asked him what was one of his most memorable moments in Ultima Online, and I want to ask you the same thing.
Oh, sure. You know, for me, I have actually a couple of that are the kind of my pinnacle memories, and they both tend to be centered around, you know, what I broadly describe as unexpected emergent behavior. One is associated with a feature that I didn't really think was really in the game in any significant way that went much beyond what it was before. Let me just give you an example. One time I was actually in the game GMing, as I would often do in those earliest days, and I happened to be invisible walking around the world, and I walked by this guy who was dressed up in a big straw hat and cut off short pants. In a tattered-looking shirt, and he was standing along a seashore fishing.
Uh-huh.
And for those who remember how the fishing simulation in Ultima Online, when it first came out, it was literally the following. It was pick up a fishing pole,
uh-huh.
Use it in the water, 50-50 chance you get a fish.
Perfect.
End of simulation. And yet, fishing had become monstrously popular right upon release.
A lot of fish bait.
Exactly. And we were sitting there, and I was so fascinated with this. I was shadowing this guy who was obviously spending hours and hours fishing. And I was just watching, you know, what could people possibly be, you know, seeing in this so I could help understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was here fishing, I saw this other gentleman come running by. There was a guy wearing plate armor and a big spiky stuff sticking up all over him. And, you know, in my mind's eye, he was clanking along as he came along the shore. And he stopped in front of the fisherman and said, "Ah, poor fisherman, you know, I am a great warrior, and I have just returned from, in great peril in the dungeon where I've won myself some great rewards, and I'm now feeling very wealthy, and so since you are a poor fisherman, I will share the bounty of my conquest with you." And he began to lay out on the ground, you know, all these treasures that he was carrying back to town. And the fisherman, again, sat there while this guy was doing this, and the fisherman responded. He said, "Look," he said, "you warmonger, you know, says, you know, take back your implements of war. I have no interest in such things." He says, "I am a fisherman. You know, every day I get up in the morning and I come here to the seashore and sit here, basking in the sun while I catch a few fish. And in the afternoon I return to town and sell that bounty. And with the few coins I gain out of that, I go to the tavern and I enjoy drinks and camaraderie with my friends. And that is the perfect life for me. So be gone, you ruffian." And I was just floored. I thought it was just one of the most amazing things that to see how deeply people could participate with just a very loose set of tools and really inspired us to really double down and make more sophisticated tools. And if you got time, I'll tell you the second one of those little stories too, which is kind of a counter story. The counter story is, again, when I was GMing this one time, and this woman was calling for help, that she kept restarting her character, and every time she'd wander out of town, a thief would come by and steal all of her stuff, and she'd have to start again, and this would happen repeatedly. So I thought, I'm as Lord British, I'll come help her, and so I teleported over to her and made myself visible again as Lord British, and she was a really brand new player, so she wasn't particularly impressed, because she didn't know who Lord British was at the time, you know, and she was just looking for help from anybody that would help, and so I said, don't worry, woman, I'll help you out here. And as she's relating the story, this thief comes running by, rides him standing there, steals from her, and runs on by. And I'm going like, "Oh, wait here, I'll take care of this." So I teleport over the guy, I freeze him to the ground, and I say, "Hey, I'm Lord, you ruffian, I'm Lord British, you know, how dare you pick on this poor hapless woman who is just trying to get to know this game, and it's really evil and cruel of you to do this, so I insist you stop her, you know, or else." And he said, "Oh, Lord British, I'm so sorry. I won't ever do it again, I
promise."
Did
he bow to you?
Oh, yeah. No, this guy was, he was acting very, sympathetically, you know. And I said, "Well, good, you know, let that be a lesson to you." And I teleported back to him and I said, I don't think I'll give you a hard time anymore. And while I'm there consoling the woman, same guy comes running by again, steals from her again, runs off the other direction. So I teleport over to him again, I freeze him again, I say, "Look, you've done it twice now. I said, if you do it again, I'm going to ban you from the game because, you know, that's really, you know, it's important to this game to not have people abusing things in this way." And he said, "Look, I really promise. I'm so sorry. I couldn't help myself. I really want to do it again." I said, "Okay." Go back to him a third time. Sure enough, comes by a third time. Freeze him a third time. I tell him I'm going to ban him. And for the first time, he breaks character and he says, "Look, Richard Garriott," said, I'm playing this game by the rules that you programmed into it. You created the class called Thief. You created these skills to be able to steal from each other. If Lord British pops up in front of my Thief character and tells him not to steal, of course he's going to say he's not going to steal. But of course, as soon as you're gone, I'm going to go steal.
So habitual Thief.
Yes, and so I thought, oh my gosh, he's right. And I really sat back and thought, oh my gosh, I really, you know, he's playing the game as we created the rules. And so I teleported him onto the other side of the world where he couldn't harass this woman. Then I did go back to the woman and say, "Now I know you're going to be fine, at least for a while, because it's going to take him a while to get back here." But it really made me sit back and think about the rules that we put into the game. In that, you know, that people are validly using the tools we created, and so if we wanted to, you know, to change that behavior, it couldn't be by game mastering, if you know what I mean. It really had to be something much more fundamental that encouraged the kinds of interactions that we really wanted the player base to have at that stage.
Now, we're talking about memorable moments and everything. I'm sure one of your other memorable moments here is probably the time you were actually assassinated.
Oh yes, by Reigns.
Yes.
Oh yeah. So in fact, you know, and now that I have a new game being released, that moment has come back to haunt me because now that we've got people in the beta test, and I still come in as with my British character into the new game,
General British now,
okay. But everybody wants to replay that moment. And, you know,
they want to be the first one assassinated.
Of course. And you know, what's funny is in the entire Ultima series, even before it was online, people would like to kill Lord British, the character.
Uh-huh.
And it kind of became this game, and each game I tried to create an immortal Lord British, and people would often find a way to kill him. So, for example, after I found people were killing Lord British for fun, I made it to where if you attacked him with a weapon, it did no damage. But then people found in one of the Ultimas that if you waited for him to go to sleep at night, his shape was no longer Lord British because there's only one character for sleeping characters. And they could kill him in his sleep with a glass sword in one of the Ultimas. They found in another Ultima, even though no weapons could kill him, if you pissed him off and he would chase you outside the castle, you could get on a ship, fire cannons at him, and I didn't put a check in the cannon damage routine, so you could still kill Lord British. Anyway, you get the idea. So this chase has been going on forever. And in later Ultimas, like in Ultima 9, we actually made a way you could kill Lord British. So we actually made it where if you waited till he was under a big metal plate, you could click on the plate and it would drop on his head and kill him. And so in Tabula Rasa, we have set it up to where the clothing that I wear as General British...
Is it like a general uniform?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
But it's very specific. You know, it's got my snake on it, and you know, it's very obvious to me. We made it into armor, so that... But it's not completely invulnerable. And I don't make myself immortal. And so when I go play inside the game Tabula Rasa right now myself, and I go into a very dangerous area, I've been killed by the monsters in the game.
Uh-huh.
But I've never yet been legitimately killed by the players. But we've purposely made it to where, though it would be very, very difficult, in theory it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so that way we can just have fun, you know, still toying with the game of letting people try.
All right.
Did you have a question?
Yes, we've got a couple of questions here.
Yeah.
From let's see, this question comes from our very own DJ Cricket at Your Radio. He says, "What do you think of Ultima Online now, and what would you have done differently if you were still on camp?"
Well, so you know, I am as thrilled as you can be that you know the Ultima series, which you know even before UO goes back to the beginning of computer gaming, almost you know effectively,
right.
You know is still going strong, and UO especially. You know, we're now 10 years into it, and you know, it's an event like this one that really just shows the legs that the game really does have. But to speculate as to what I would do differently is difficult. But because here's the not only, of course, have I not been in the thick of it, so it's hard for me to know what I would really do much the same or differently. But as I'm sure you guys understand, when you develop an online game, you know, the 50 or 100 people that sit and make it, like, let's say, I often use the city of Austin here as an online gaming metaphor, where I go, imagine that those of us in this room decided to build the city of Austin over a few years in a field, and at the end of a few years of building it, we invite in 1 million people to come move in into the city. You know, what's the probability it's going to work very well? You know, pretty close to zero. And so that's what it's like to launch an online game. And then even once you got it working, the people in that community are going to basically demand movement and change in the rules and structures of that environment. And so that game is no longer really the purview purely of the designers and developers. In fact, if they're smart designers and developers, like smart city planners, they don't make the city in the city planner's image. They make the city in the image of its populace and what they want, the populace wants out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so the fact that this community is still thriving implies to me that the developers down through the years, though I'm sure all of us in my time and in their time have made a variety of mistakes and ups and downs as to how well we've matched, you know, the populace's desires. In total, it appears everybody's doing a good job.
Right.
Just by the very nature of the fact that we're all still here playing.
You mentioned mistakes and stuff like that, and, you know, where developers have made mistakes in the past. I'm sure you probably had your own set of mistakes and stuff, or things that you either regret that you hadn't put in. Or, you know, you kind of touched on it a little earlier, like you didn't realize that the rules, that you had put rules in there, and they were playing under the rules that you had already in place. My question is, did you have any regrets about those rules being in place, or do you wish you had pre-planned more better to where, I mean, any regrets at all? Because, I mean,
regret is a big word. You know, it sounds like a tougher word than I would apply to it,
mm-hmm.
but I can definitely give you a couple of examples of clear mistakes, but that I chalk them up really to the learning experience more than regret.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like one clear mistake, you know, was this big virtual ecology system we put in the game, where we spent, you know, man months, if not years, on developing this very complicated, self-balancing, you know, carnivore and herbivore, you know, predator system. To where it would automatically generate quests and all this other kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And once the game went, and it worked great when there was no players in the game, and then as soon as we launched it live, the players killed off every level of every creature, herbivore, carnivore, etc. And so they, you know, so the, it was a useless system. And so no one even noticed it.
Mm-hmm.
And we eventually just pulled it out because it was so useless.
Right.
On the other hand, when you go back to people like playing as thieves in ways that I believe actually hurt the community, you know, I think PvP is great. I think thieving skills are great, as long as you find ways to make sure even the prey, the people who get preyed upon, aren't being downtrodden in a way that prevents them from enjoying the game also,
mm-hmm.
Which was commonly happening in those earliest days. And so the lessons we learned out of that was how to make sure that, or at least my personal takeaways, are, you know, making sure that PvP is more consensual. You know, doing things like getting rid of anonymity. One of the things that used to happen a lot in those earliest days when people would have a couple of different characters. They'd log in as their evil character, do something nefarious, log out, log back in with their friendly character to the same guy, go, oh, I'm so sorry, and follow them around being friendly, and then time is right, switch to the character that goes and kills them off because they know where they are. And these ways that anonymity really became an easy way to exploit the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde methods of you know, having a dual personality in the game. And, you know, and so there's things that I've learned to avoid and rules we've changed in the new games that I'm developing. You know, at least I'm responding to it. I believe these guys are, too.
Right.
You know, that's just chalk it up to lessons learned.
I know you work in the MMO industry a lot and everything. You even got your own MMO, Tabula Rasa.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, where do you think the market will ever shift to MMOs that are more realistic, more realism and stuff like that? Do you think there is a market out there for realism, for every effect that you do is going to have an opposite consequence for other people?
What's interesting about that is that I am still amazed that Ultima Online remains the only MMO that has done even this level of reality simulation. Almost every other MMO to date is chasing what I'll call the EverQuest model. And I find that to be shocking and disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
As a creator and a player, I think, Ultima Online is the most interesting, one of the most interesting directions to go. And yet no one else in the intervening 10 years has really chosen to chase it. And I think that's another reason why UOS has survived and sustained so well is because people are avoiding it for whatever reason. And I think that's actually a very exciting opportunity. It not only allows UO to flourish, but it means that the question you asked is, do I think that those kinds of games will have even more cause and effect and more direct results of all the varieties of ways you can interact with the world? I sure hope people do that. And if our competitors don't, I sure hope I personally am one of the ones that
I hope you do too, because I will be there playing it when you do.
So I'm a big believer in it. So yes, I sure hope it does.
Excellent. I think we have a question here from one of our listeners out there. And
yes, Richard, we have a question. This is for Bay Runner,
One
of my listeners at UO Radio. Bay Runner wants to know, have you ever played KR? And if yes, what do you think of it? And if no, what good and or bad things have you heard about it so far?
Well, to answer the question, it'll be obvious when I say, what's KR?
Kingdom Reborn.
I'm sorry?
Kingdom
Reborn.
Reborn.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, and I have not.
All right.
While I've been working here on Tabula Rasa, to be honest, this last year and almost a year and a half, I actually played exactly zero other games.
That's probably a good thing.
The last other game I played, I did play 20 levels of World of Warcraft when it came out, and I think it's a great game. I enjoyed it through that span.
It's not your cup of tea?
No, I have very little critical things to say about it. My only issue with it, I actually think that the Blizzard games are all very noteworthily well done from what I'll call a art direction and polish of the user interface and polish of the challenge reward cycle. But it is one of the games in what I'll call the EverQuest mold. And all of those games, to me, for my personal taste, tend to eventually fall into a pattern or a rut of the level grind, where people begin to focus much more attention on their inventory management, managing their damage over time, and farming for golden experience points that loses my attention after 20 or 30 levels. And so that's why I think games like UO and hopefully games like my new game, Tabula Rasa, will break out of that mold.
Okay. We have another question.
Yeah, I have a couple of not very lengthy questions here from one of our listeners, Magnus, over here at UO Radio. First question is, whatever happened to Pagan?
So it's interesting. So if you look through the history of Ultimas, even if they all went perfectly well, I'd still have favorites and less favorites, but in fact there are definitely some that went better than others, if you follow my meaning. Whereas the first three Ultimas were Richard Garriott Learns How to Program, Ultima 4 is one of my personal favorites because it was the first time where I really started to pay attention to storycraft and really decided to invent my own world from the ground up. And I think it was pretty successful, and it was actually the first number one best-selling Ultima, I think, as a result of that. Then Ultimas 5, 6, and 7, kind of refined my storytelling skills. Ultima 7 was another personal favorite in that I felt, other than UO, up until UO, it was the best refined interaction with the cause and effect in the world.
Yeah.
Ultima 8, however, had an interesting history. Ultima 8, I think that my initial vision for Ultima 8 I still very much believe in, and I think it was a very good one. However, that was the first game we did after we had Origin and joined forces with EA, and I'm not blaming EA in any way for this. I think EA is a brilliant company, and I love many of the executives there, and I'm not trying to say anything disparaging at all with this. But they are very good at year cycle sports products that get they time their marketing with their product releases and get a lot of multipliers out of the value of that. And so when we first joined forces, they would describe the value that they believed came from even if you have to cut the game features in order to make the ship date, the value of making the ship date, lining up of the marketing, will exceed that. And I was a believer. So, I mean, they didn't make me do anything. They convinced me, however, that that was the right thing to do. Out of goodness, they actually believed it too. We all believed it. But in hindsight, I can clearly look back at that and go, it was absolutely the wrong thing for the product. We ended up, cutting out parts of the game that were, all the way to the point where, the cloth maps, which usually are a reasonably accurate representation of the world, the ultimate map actually has nothing to do with the world because there were huge parts that were removed in order to make our ship date, to where the map didn't even line up with the content. And so it was really just, in my mind, hamstrung. We later, just because of the development team was so, upset with ourselves, that we had later released patches and things to correct it. But, of course, from a retail standpoint, it's too late. But still, just to make ourselves feel good, we kind of fixed up all the parts that we could before we moved on to Ultima 9.
So how hard was it for you to step away from Ultima and actually create a new MMO? How hard was that for you?
Well, of course, leaving the fold of Origin and Ultima was extraordinarily traumatic at a personal level. The challenge of building a new world was in some way refreshing, but also it's proven to be extraordinarily daunting. And the reason why I would describe it that way is if you look at Ultima. The early Ultimas were built when computers were quite simple, so there wasn't any room to put much content. And that allowed me to take a decade or two to evolve the reality of Ultima. And so that's convenient, so to speak, to let you deepen it over time. For Tabula Rasa, I had to, since anything I do from now on is going to be directly compared with Ultima.
Right.
And so therefore, if I did everything perfectly, I would create another world that was at least as powerful and at least as rich and at least as deep as Britannia for Tabula Rasa. And to do that all in one product cycle is, of course, nigh but impossible. And so that has proven to be one of my biggest challenges on Tabula Rasa is how to follow up. It's a tough act to follow. And that's one of the reasons it's taken me so long is to really deepen it as much as I can before I'm really ready to release it.
I want you to know I'm going to play that game.
Great,
I'm an EVE Online player, and I've been watching you. I've made periodic visits to your website.
I'm
watching closely.
And I think one thing that's important to say here, especially since I'm here at an Ultima event, is that of course I hope people come and try out Tabula Rasa. But also, it's worth noting that Tabula Rasa is not Ultima. Nor is it a sci-fi Ultima. Ultima is what I'll describe a sandbox game, and again, has not been followed up, as we were saying a little earlier, and I think it's one of its real values. And I hope that, perhaps in whatever I do next might actually be more in the vein of the sandbox reality game. But Tabula Rasa was a purposeful departure, not only from Ultima, but also from what I'll call all the EverQuest clones that pretty much every other MMO is. It is much more what I'll call combat-themed, military-themed, and I think that if people like it, but it's I believe it's a very, very good game and very unlike any other MMO that's out there. But it really won't displace people's loves for Ultima Online. I think that it's so much different that if you like it, that you will still love and you owe just the same, I think.
Richard, Agnes also would like to know is would you ever be interested in going back to helping to create Ultima Online, and do you still play Ultima Online?
So I haven't played for some years at this stage, but mostly just because I'm so caught up in new activities of my own. But would I like to, if the opportunity availed itself, of course I would take it. I actually think that I would be very happy to contribute and think I could provide significant value to the endeavors. However, on the other hand, I think the probability of it occurring is low.
Yeah.
And that's not because of personal choice. I think it's just because of corporate realities.
Yeah.
I just think statistically, unless one of these companies buys the other, which you never know. That stuff happens now and then. I think otherwise the probabilities are pretty low.
So, what even got you into creating these games? I mean, what forced you, or the forcing push, or the pushing force that got you to start designing these?
Well, it's interesting that I think that when everybody goes, everyone has to go through school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an age at which, if you're lucky, you find a hobby that can become your vocation. And the people who manage to find that, I think, are, you know, it's easier to be happier in life, so to speak, if you are lucky enough to have that occur. And I feel very, very lucky that that I stumbled into that, because previous to finding a computer, I have a really overeducated family. You know, my dad's an astronaut, has multiple doctorate degrees. My eldest brother is a medical doctor. My older brother, Robert, who's my business partner, has multiple master's degrees. My mom has a master's degree. My younger sister has a master's degree. And I dropped out of school to play games for a living. And it's funny that, you know, growing up with this whole, you know, with this education, overly educated group around me, I was going through school just doing kind of what everybody else did. Not because I thought it was interesting, but just because it was kind of the family thing to do. And so I was like a double E electrical engineering major at UT. But I remember sitting in the classes going like, well, of all the classes I'm taking, it's the most interesting. But I really can't say I was passionately going to go be a, you know, do the activities of an electrical engineering major. During that same period of time, I didn't realize it was going to be a vocation because there was no industry called the computer games industry yet. But I started making these games on my own because, you know, like those earliest machines, like the Apple II, was this blank canvas, this blank, you know, place to create art, so to speak. But that even the rules of the canvas were so unknown that, unlike my mother, you know, who's an artist, where, you know, if I'm going to learn to be an artist, there's a lot of catching up you got to do to catch up to all the other artists in the world, and, you know, good luck doing it. But this canvas was not only blank, but all the tools didn't exist. And so any tool that I invented was, by definition, state-of-the-art. And so I suddenly became a, quote, state-of-the-art developer, since there weren't any others, you know, from the get-go. And that's a very exciting place to be. You know, I can't explain, you know, why it stuck that way. But I can tell you that once it started, you know, it was, you know, very obviously my passionate pursuit. But it took probably a decade before I realized it was a career.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. What would you say, in Ultima, you had a bunch of virtues and stuff like that. Which one would you say you personally uphold the most? Which one would you say you resonate with the most?
Well, you know, that's interesting. One of my tests to see if I had come up with the virtues correctly was I would actually work out these little... You remember the gypsy you talked to uh-huh. you know, to determine your personality, so to speak? I would craft those questions over and over and over again and give those tests to my friends in such a way to where I wanted to make sure there wasn't
like
a natural bias.
Personality test, right?
Yeah. And so it was difficult for me for a long time to kind of choose one because I was purposely trying to give them power or reduce their power to, you know, to even them out. If I have to give an answer, so to speak, I also have to explain it in the sense of I would probably pick spirituality, even though in a traditional sense, in anybody's traditional sense, I would not normally be described as a spiritual person. You know, I'm not religious. I don't think of it as I don't think of that term in a supernatural way. I actually just think of that term in a caring way. You know, about your spirit, the what kind of a spirit are you in your operations through life? If I had to pick one, that would be it.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about Tabula Rasa. How long you've been working on it? How long has it been beta? And when is it expected to come out of beta?
So in reverse order, it's coming out quite soon. It's actually going to be October 19th is when it'll be available commercially. And although we're actually opening up to the pre-sale boxes on the store shelves now, and so we're going to cycle the servers, so to speak, on October 16th. Then backing up from that, we've been running the beta all this year. Starting in January, we started letting in our, quote, friends and family. We've been ramping it up to where, I think today we've already invited in like 70,000 people or so, and we have another 100,000 or so we'll be inviting in through these next few weeks as our final kind of push for load testing. But how long it's been going on is quite a bit longer. It's been, you know, the what I consider the tabula rasa that is shipping has been in development almost 5 years. But it's really been closer to 7 years since we formed NCSoft. But those first couple of years, we're really building the company, building the team, We had one false start through that cycle too, but the team and the design that we're now getting ready to ship has been in development almost 5 years.
Uh-huh. You worked on a lineage for a while, didn't you?
Yes, but that was mostly as what I'll call an analyst and a feedback loop for them to try to help our Korean office understand the U.S. Market, mm-hmm. just like they now are working really hard to try to get us to help understand the Korean market.
Right?
Like a consultant. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And so it was mostly playing the game, providing written feedback as to ways they might try to optimize it for the United States.
Now let me ask you this: is there anything that you want to tell people about Tabula Rasa that might get them interested to the game? For those that might not know anything about Tabula Rasa.
Yeah. So here's kind of my three bullet point messages about why I think it's such a different MMO. And I'll do it to describe, here's where I'm critical on most MMOs. And what's interesting is I've actually never tested this critique against UO until just this moment, because I haven't, of course, been in a UO-specific environment. But I think that UO players will be pleased to know, will be pleased with my answers, because it's my critique of the state of the MMO market isn't very critical of UO, because I really think UO is still a really great game. And I think they'll understand this criticism, though, of most every other MMO.
Right.
Which is most MMOs, when you go into combat with creatures, mm-hmm. After you have a target, you now stare at your shortcut bar versus the environment of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You start managing your damage over time and your inventory management to optimize it. When you're fighting creatures, the quest, when you're level one, you get sent to the level one hunting ground to the north. Then the level two, you go to the east. And level three, you go to the west, and you farm for experience points and treasure drops. And then when you go up a level, you're going to move to the new farming areas. And they're almost this kind of turn-based whack-a-mole that goes on, in these games. And the games themselves are actually quite static.
Mm-hmm.
If you go kill off a bunch of monsters to the east, you could literally take a few steps back, and a few moments later, that monster will spawn right back in where it was, so the next person can come along and farm it for SXP. So we've made some really big changes in that for Tabula Rasa. What we did is first of all, the game is much more what I call action-oriented. It's still an RPG. It's still my character's attributes and equipment versus yours, with the die rolls, so to speak, or probabilities for damage and hits. But in addition to our equipment, we also take the 3D environment into play. So, for example, if I'm shooting someone across the room over there where I can see them from head to toe, they're completely exposed and I have 100% of my normal chance to hit them. On the other hand, since I'm hanging out here behind this table, it means that, and you can only see half my body, it means I reduce the probabilities of damage by 50%. If I crouch down behind cover, it cuts it down to like 75%. On the other hand, if I'm crouched down and the monster attacks me hand to hand, I'm more immobile, and so I can take much more damage. And the result of that subtle change in the way we do combat means that instead of just staring at your shortcut bar and managing your damage over time, you're paying attention to how monsters are moving around you, because they'll flank around to the side to get a shot from the side, and you dang well better move or you're in trouble.
Right.
And similarly, instead of just walking down the middle of the street with your guns blazing,
bang, bang.
You're moving from cover to cover to cover like you would in a real game, but it's not an arcade game, it's not a shooter, it is a tactical RPG. That's one. Number two is, out of three, number two is what I call the dynamic battlefield, where instead of just things respawning where they were, creatures actually have strategic goals. And so they actually will try to take fortresses and outposts and take them over and then defend them from the players. And if they take over a town, that means all the shops, all of the hospitals to respawn, that means all the mission givers, that means all the waypoints for rapid transit, that means all the automatic defenses all change sides. And so therefore it's unavailable to players until the players go retake it. And so there's real consequences to the gaining and loss of territory.
Mm-hmm.
And then number three is the inclusion of story. Most MMOs, you do exactly what you're told. You follow the missions. No missions are in conflict with other missions. You just go from one to the next to the next to the next, and that's how you level grind. In Tabula Rasa, we commonly give you quick missions that are from various NPC factions that cannot be accomplished at the same time.
Right.
And so you begin to have to make judgment calls as to who are you going to remain friendly with, who are you going to piss off or disappoint, and live with the results of those choices. And then we have these, what I consider now, ethical parables, culminate in instance spaces, which are all very custom-built, kind of epic conclusions to story threads, to where, again, I think from a storytelling, which is almost disappeared in most MMOs. You know, Tabby DeRosa does, I think, a good first stab at telling meaningful stories in an MMO setting.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for your time and everything, Richard Gary. And I think some of these people out here want to get with you for a presentation and everything.
Oh, great.
So I think Jacone is going to get over here with you.
Excellent, excellent.
I'm going to let him take you away with him and everything.
Well, great. Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for the interview, and thank you. I want to have another one with you later.
Yep.